This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. How do you get a tasty, healthful dinner on the table quickly? How do you keep from falling back on the same old dishes night after night, week after week? Well, here's what you do. You reach for your wok or your skillet and get ready to stir fry. Our guest this afternoon is food writer and cooking teacher Nancy McDermott. She's the author of 8 cookbooks, including 300 best stir fry recipes. In the book are recipes for dishes familiar and unfamiliar, from kung pao chicken to lime splashed salmon with chilies and cilantro. There are meatless main dishes, side dishes, and rice and noodle dishes. Listeners, I hope you'll join us this afternoon with your questions and comments for our guest, Nancy McDermott. Perhaps you have a recipe you'd like to share with us. I look forward to your phone calls. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. In addition to 300 best stir-fry recipes, Nancy McDermott's cookbooks include Quick and Easy Vietnamese, Real Thai, Real Vegetarian Thai, and, now for something completely different, Southern Cakes. She specializes in the cuisines of Southeast Asia. She lives in the South. She is a native of North Carolina, and that's where she and her family live. In addition to her cookbooks, Nancy McDermott has written about food and travel for several publications, including Bon Appetit, Cooks Illustrated, and Food and Wine. You'll find our guest on the web at www.nancymcdermott.com. And let me spell the name for you. Nancy is spelled with an I-E, N-A-N-C-I-E, and McDermott, M-C-D-E-R-M-O-T-T, two T's at the end. Her book, 300 Best Stir Fry Recipes, is published by Robert Rose. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, it's my pleasure. This is you're my new fan club, and I sure appreciate it.
Well, it's been so much fun cooking with this book.
Oh.
My husband and I we've had it. It came in a couple of months ago, and I took it home and we started working on it. So we've done a number of things, and we're really enjoying it. Your interest, let's get right to it, though. Your interest in the cuisines of Southeast Asia began with a stint in the Peace Corps. What did you do? Where did you serve?
Well, I was in Thailand. I was in the northeastern region called the Isan region. I was about 50 miles north of the Cambodian border, just sort of right about where Laos and Cambodia intersect at that far corner of Thailand. And I just fell for Thai food, Thai culture, everything about Thailand. And people were stir-frying and cooking great food all around me, but I have to confess, I really didn't learn to cook Thai food or Asian food until I got home, and I didn't have all those restaurants and neighbors and friends, and, you know, I kind of missed my chance to go look into my neighbor's wok, but, you know, just like if you're hungry to communicate with somebody, you can learn the language. I just got books, and I had Southeast Asian students in my English as a Second Language classes, and started putting things together and have been going back and cooking ever since.
Yeah. How do Thai home cooks approach a wok and a dish?
A wok is the most, I mean, it's a lot like a skillet here. It's actually not all that different, but there's sort of saucepans for soups and curries, and then a wok pretty much for everything else. And it's the one thing about wok cooking and stir-frying in Thailand as opposed to Hong Kong and some of the things that you read about traditional Chinese stir-frying is a typical kitchen has two small charcoal stoves. They're shaped like a bucket, and people put charcoal in the top, and they light it, and they fan it to turn up the heat, and they take coals out and drop them in a pot next to the stove to turn it down. So you don't have real fine-tuning there, and they're usually cooking. They put in some oil. When it's hot, they put in garlic. When it sizzles and smells good, they put in some meat, toss, 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 put in some vegetables, toss, 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 a little fish sauce, you know, maybe some chilies, maybe a little bit of broth, and that's it. I mean, it's just a very simple, they don't think about it as this, you know, it's sort of like I'll cook some eggs. You know, you're not holding onto the book or thinking about it. And it's just a very fast, fresh, energy efficient way to, you know, put meals together and make the most of meat. And they love their vegetables. So it's just kind of a second nature way of cooking in Asia, all over Asia.
Yeah, it was interesting to read in the opening of the book that the Thai word for stir fry translates as with rice.
Well, that's actually the word for... I'm sorry. Yes, you're exactly right. I'm blanking here. Gapkao. And so people will say, what's going with the rice tonight? Now, gapkao could also apply to curries and to other things, but more than anything else, people may not have a curry every night. They may not have a fried fish every night, but they're almost always going to have soup, and they're almost always going to have one or more stir-fried dishes. So people don't say, oh, we're having chicken or we're having beef or we're having pork. You'd say, well, we're going to have chicken stir-fried with zucchini and chilies, and I've got a fish curry, and we've got, you know, eggs with something, something. You know, they're thinking of a whole dish with a lot of flavors, not chicken, pork, beef, shrimp. You know, we're so protein-oriented. And they're really sort of flavor and variety-oriented. And they'd rather eat some bites of three different yummy things than one great big, you know, half a chicken at a buffet. Which is actually a very good, you know, to savor the food and to make vegetables taste good and, you know, to sort of put an interesting meal together, I think is a great way to shift our focus in a direction that happens to be in a healthier direction than, you know, than we sometimes tend to go. Yeah.
And these recipes are feeding four people, and you're maybe using half a pound of protein.
Exactly. I mean, that, and people have asked me about that. You know, if I show you the amount of chicken I'm going to put in a stir fry, you may think, you're cutting that up four ways and I'm only going to get part of it. But it's, you know, it's a different take. It's not like, here is your pork chop. It's, here is pork sauteed with, you know, green beans and a chili sauce, and, you know, there's garlic in there. And when I do say it serves four, you've got to presume something to go with it, which could, in most of Asia, would be rice. It could be noodles tossed with sesame oil. My family favorite is couscous that, you know, cooks in 5 minutes off the stove. So it's not like a bowl of beef stew where you can dip bread into it or not. But it's a I often do a stir fry and a great big salad and rice or noodles. Yeah. And, you know, that makes, to me, an interesting meal. I can eat lots and lots of salad and feel very satisfied. And, you know, it's a great way to go, especially summertime with vegetables.
Yeah. Once you get the hang of this, too, you know how things go together. And then you can get it done really quickly, and you just take what you've got on hand. And one of the reasons that my husband and I really like this is all the vegetables you can put in, the variety. And one of the things that also that we've learned from the book is there are things that you can have on the side, and maybe you don't even need to get the wok out, but maybe you're having something else for dinner. Maybe you're having that pork chop. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you can take corn kernels and cherry tomatoes and add some big, bold flavors, as a certain TV guy would say, and quickly stir-fry them, and you've got peppery corn kernels with cherry tomatoes.
Exactly. And so if you pick up a rotisserie chicken or, you know, barbecue or, you know, last night's grilled salmon that you're going to, you know, sort of turn into a salad or something, you're exactly right. The stir-fry can be not the main thing, but, in fact, cooking vegetables, and I think the brilliant thing about the way that Asian cooks in general approach vegetables that gets lost in Asian restaurants in the West is the tendency is to cook one thing by itself or just with a little bit of combination. If you go to a Chinese restaurant, they've got eight precious treasure vegetables, and it's cauliflower and snow peas and carrots and broccoli and, you know, all these things, and they're sort of tumbled together, and you know it's good for you, but it doesn't taste particularly wonderful. But then when you're leaving, you see the staff sitting down, and they've got some kind of meat something, and they've got this platter of dark green greens with some sauce on them, and it's like, what the heck is that? It's like, you don't like that. We've taught them we want lots of meat. But I've got just bok choy with garlic, iceberg lettuce, stir-fried, yes, garlic-scented zucchini, stir-fried celery hearts, Asian eggplant with peppers and peas. That one gets a little bit busy, but it's still all about the eggplant. Szechuan seasoned Napa cabbage, gingery Chinese broccoli. If you're just doing one vegetable and you're doing it in the hot wok, it cooks really quickly. It's brilliantly colored. It's so good for you, but don't emphasize that because it really just does taste good, and it's often good cold the next day.
Hmm. Tell us about fragrant iceberg lettuce. This was something I'd never had thought of doing, and I haven't yet done it, but how does that go together, and what's that dish like?
Well, the thing about that is, it's faster than any because you're really just kind of wilting it. If you've ever had sort of a wilted spinach salad where it's or spinach that's cooked kind of in an Italian style. Of course, Asian people do that too, in a little bit of garlic so that it softens up and almost loses its crunch, but is still green, still fresh, not cooked off to death. It's a little bit of 2 tablespoons of oil, 1 tablespoon of garlic. You get that hot and fragrant, and you put the lettuce in, spread it out, toss it for 1 minute, add the salt and sugar, and toss it again. Little sesame oil at the end, which keeps it from being dull. And usually you would put liquid, maybe a couple of tablespoons of broth or water or something, even in a vegetable stir fry, but because it's so moist naturally, you're really just sort of turning that over in garlicky oil. And the Asian sesame oil, I think, is really a magic ingredient to have if one wants to, you know, sort of do a lot of this cooking. Because it's usually in supermarkets. It doesn't even really send you to the Asian store. I mean, here in North Carolina, it's 2 bottles over from the soy sauce. And it's sesame seeds that are toasted and then ground to make this nutty, aromatic, wonderful oil that's used at the end, just a teaspoon or two at the end of cooking. It's not a cooking oil, but it's like adding a little balsamic vinegar or something to, you know, to a dish. It just delivers this interestingness to a plain vegetable that just, as I said, it's usually good hot, cold, or at room temperature.
Yeah. What are some of the other essential pantry items for stir fries?
Well, a good basic vegetable oil. Olive oil is not my favorite. You can do it as long as you're not trying to go really, really hot, because of course olive oil, you know, breaks down at a lower temperature. But I've been at people's houses; that's all they had, and it even works fine. But just any kind of vegetable oil. I use lots of garlic and lots of onions for condiments. Soy sauce, Asian sesame oil. I love hoisin sauce, and again, that's one that's pretty easy to get in supermarkets without even going to an Asian market. Those three will take you through, I'm sure, well over half the recipes in the book. And in the vegetable section, in fact, you're often just using salt. You know, you're not even putting soy sauce. You would think that soy sauce goes in every Asian dish, and it doesn't. If you want to go a little bit further, fish sauce, which is the quintessential seasoning of Thailand, Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia, is a great pantry staple, and it does have a fishy aroma, but that dissipates in cooking, and it's kind of like cooking with wine. It adds a little bit of complexity to the sauce, and there's the Vietnamese beef with watercress called shaking beef that is just a wonderful, very quick sort of take on steak. The photograph is on page 96, and the recipe is on page 70 in the book, and that is a great thick steak cut up and marinated with a little bit of soy sauce and a little bit of fish sauce, and it's sort of like steak and salad. You take red onions and slice them thinly and put them on a serving platter with a little bit of vinegar and salt, and you toss the onions so that they're kind of getting a little bit sweet and softened, and you put chopped watercress over top of that. And then you just quickly stir fry, kind of flipping these chunks of seasoned steak around in the pan. And as soon as they're done and garlicky and brown and delicious, you turn that all out on top of a bed of watercress and kind of toss the whole thing together. And it's just a glorious, you know, sort of summertime flavors in any time of year. But you do need fish sauce for that one because it's Vietnamese style.
Yeah. Do you think these recipes would be things that... Or stir fry in general, is it something that a beginning cook can be comfortable with?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's sort of a confidence aspect to it. And as you said, once you've done it, it becomes like, to me, like making pancakes, where it's like, oh, I'm going to make pancakes and getting the stuff out. You know, you may be measuring something, but you may be thinking, I'll throw these blueberries in, or you may be thinking, wonder if I should put jelly on them. You know, you're not hampered by the process. And once you know how to do it and are confident, you start saying, oh, I've got half a pepper and 2 zucchini in the bottom of the crisper here. I will, you know, I could do this. Could I do that? You know, you become, you realize it's not, you don't need all 300 recipes. You'll be making up your own based on what you like, what's in your garden, that, you know, that kind of thing. But it's, one issue is, one thing that I like about it is that for a beginning cook, you're hands-on. There's the pan, you're looking at it. You're putting the garlic in, and, you know, if you read the directions, it says, when it smells good, put this in. The maybe intimidating thing is, there you are looking right in the pan, and it's best if you do it on higher heat. You know, you can do it on lower heat, but things will tend to sort of steam more, but it is a sort of a fast in and out, and I would say just to, for somebody to like pick some of the simpler, you know, fewer ingredients means a simpler recipe, and maybe work with the bok choy or the broccoli or some of the vegetable-only dishes where you don't have to worry about getting meat done, you don't have to cut that up, and get confident with the process, and then, you know, then expand. You can also put in shrimp or chicken or salmon that's already cooked, and that takes, you know, that takes away the worry of how long does this have to cook to get done. But with stir-frying, you can pretty much see. I mean, when it's changed colors and you got thinly sliced beef, you can check it, but in the time that it takes you to do what I tell you to do, it's pretty much going to be done.
Yeah. It's a great kind of thing to do with leftovers.
Oh, absolutely. That's where, you know, how can I use this? How can I use that? It's almost like a sandwich in a way, once you get used to it, because, you know the basic drill, and it's like, okay, I've got this and this. And, you know, and that's just cooking, and that's kind of what, with a couple of generations of, you know, people being busy and, you know, grandma's not home telling us to do this her way, or, you know, that too bad about that, but also men can get in there and cook, which, you know, my grandfather, maybe he would have loved to cook, but all he could do was help with the coconut and the fruitcake at Christmas time. But anybody can kind of get in there and do it. You can kind of do it for your pleasure. Think of all the things we have to work with that, you know, old-time cooks just had what was in their garden. You can, yeah. You know, you can go, in fact, one shortcut that, especially for maybe a less confident cook or somebody who's in a hurry, is to shop the salad bar. So if you want a dish with some peppers and some onions and some broccoli florets or zucchini, you could go to the salad bar, buy exactly what you need for that dish, and you've cut out the step of chopping, whether it's intimidating or just time-consuming. You know, that's a way to kind of express things out a little bit, because it is an intrinsically quick method of cooking. The chopping can, you know, the chopping is the thing that, and organizing it can take, you know, is the time taker here as opposed to in the Western kitchen.
Yeah. One nice thing about the salad bar, too, is that you need to buy only what you're going to use.
Exactly.
So instead of having, you know, a head of cauliflower and a head, you know, and several stalks of broccoli, you could just buy what you're going to use so you don't have it going bad.
That science project, I won't tell you, but that reminds me, I need to clean out my crisper because we were away for a week, and there's an eggplant that I should have cooked before we left. It's efficient in that way. And, the good thing about having a refrigerator is you can shop ahead and you have all this wonderful stuff. But if something is in the refrigerator and you don't see it, you're not thinking about it. I mean, that's one thing I really like for people to keep: soy sauce, fish sauce, you know, anything that you can keep out on the counter safely. I mean, it wouldn't hurt soy sauce to be in the refrigerator, but it doesn't need it. It's an ancient seasoning. It's a salted, you know, it is a preserved sort of seasoning, and if things are out there, you're going to use them. I actually keep garlic out, a little basket with garlic, some dried chilies, a couple of shallots out on the counter, and I try to keep a few plum tomatoes in there. And, you know, if they start looking like they're tired, I cut that tired part off and use them. Whereas if things that are in the fridge, you know, some things you have to keep in the fridge. I also try to keep herbs like cilantro. You can put the stems in water in a jar and cover it loosely with a plastic bag, and it'll keep in the fridge a week. But if you leave it or basil or something out on the counter and, you know, get yourself used to using it, you won't need it to last a week. You know, you will have used it up in that time.
Yeah. And basil keeps wonderfully in a vase of water.
Absolutely. Looks pretty, smells good. You know, it just kind of has you in the, you know, we're sort of a clean countertops kind of culture, and that, you know, that's one thing that I remember about Asian kitchens. Well, first of all, in the countryside in Thailand, when I was there, a refrigerator was very uncommon. There was one at our school, and it was used to keep drinks cool for special guests. So cooks went to the market every day and had, you know, if you had something perishable, you used it up at that meal. Now, I'm not recommending that people get rid of their refrigerators. But, you know, thinking of, you know, having things out and having, you know, a big bowl of fruit and having a couple of tomatoes out there, you know, that inspires you. That reminds you, you know, this kitchen is a place to use, and if it gets dirty, we just clean it back up. It's not a science lab.
Mm. One thing that I would be interested in your comments on, I love ginger, and we use it a lot, but it can go on you really quickly. You got any ideas for saving ginger?
Now, a standard thing from when I first started doing Asian cooking was to peel it and put it in a jar with sherry.
Oh.
Which, I mean, it could be Shaoxing rice wine, but I generally use sherry. The rice wine is salted, and I find that a very good substitute. But it will keep for, oh gosh, I would say at least a month. And to peel ginger, if you hold it in your palm, if you're right-handed, hold it in your left palm and take a spoon and turn it upside down. So you've got the, you know, the pointed part of the spoon facing up and the rounded bowl is, you know, is facing you. And you just pull down on the skin, and it just peels right off. And you can take the skin off of ginger in a minute and a half doing that. I mean, you can also cut it and sort of cut down on the sides, but that's a neat little way to peel it. And then stick that in a jar, and when you need it, pull it up, chop off what you need, put the rest back in.
Now, can you leave that in a cupboard or on the counter? Or do you have to put it
in
the fridge?
No, that I would put in the fridge.
Yeah, okay.
Just for, yeah. You know, it's alcohol, but, you know, if you put it in the fridge, nothing's going to happen to it. If you left it out, it probably wouldn't mold, but it would start to, you know, turn to wine or vinegar or something.
Because I know it's very important once you put garlic into something like oil, you really have to keep it in the fridge.
Oh, exactly. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. This was definitely a fridge trick. And again, I actually leave ginger out on my counter in that basket. I would definitely put ginger on my, you know, going back to the list of things, garlic and ginger and shallots or some kind of onions are sort of good basic, and green onions as well, garlic, ginger, shallots. Green onions are, you know, things to sort of keep on hand all the time because you'll use them a lot. And I buy just sort of a, you know, sort of a handful-sized chunk of ginger. And if it's out there in that basket, I see it and I use it. Mm. If it's the other way to store it in the fridge that's simpler is you'd wrap it in, I think, wrap a paper towel around it and put it in a plastic bag loosely. Now, you don't want to seal things like that off because that will encourage them to mold. But once something like that goes into my crisper, I forget it's there. I don't use it.
Mm. So. Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is food writer and cooking teacher Nancy McDermott. She's the author of 8 cookbooks, including the one we're talking about this afternoon, 300 Best Stir-Fry Recipes. In addition to her cookbooks, she has written about food and travel for several publications, including Bon Appetit, Cooks Illustrated, and Food and Wine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Perhaps you've got a tip or a recipe you'd like to share. We'd love to hear from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. When did the wok begin to be a common piece of equipment in American kitchens?
I would say 70s to 80s. And I think one problem is that it kind of came in as a gourmet, you know, very, very much a specialty thing, high price, and came with a lot of rules. And I think the wok came in as part of becoming a serious devotee and student of Chinese cooking. And nothing wrong with that. I am one, and I put, did I do a bibliography in this book? Let me look. Yes, on page 345, I list about 10 books. One of my very favorites is The Key to Chinese Cooking by Irene Kuo, anything by Florence Lin, L-I-N, and anything by Grace Young, Y-O-U-N-G. Grace Young has The Breath of a Wok, which is, if someone's interested in wok cooking, even if they don't plan to do it, The Breath of a Wok by Grace Young, it's a Simon & Schuster book, kind of, she's Chinese-American, born in San Francisco, but she goes back to Hong Kong and mainland China and back to San Francisco, and she visits her aunties and her uncles and kind of looks at how the wok actually was put aside by Chinese immigrants coming into the West because, you know, here they are in a kitchen with a flat stove and their kids want, you know, hamburgers and you're busy and so forth. And she's really interested in it as this ancient tool that still resonates. And the part of the unfortunate baggage that I think came in with, you know, with the wok and with you got to be serious about Chinese cooking is that it's hard and there are all these rules. And, you know, if you don't, you know, get the oil up to X temperature, what will happen? Will your stove blow up? Will the, you know, it's really, I came to it watching people do it in Asia. I wasn't thinking I'm going to do this. I wasn't thinking this is interesting. But when I came home and wanted to do it and started, you know, encountering sometimes a sense of Chinese cooking is like this, I said, wait a minute. That's, you know, that may be true in Canton, but everything that happens in a Cantonese kitchen doesn't happen in a Sichuan kitchen, doesn't happen in a Beijing kitchen. And when wok cooking ended up in Southeast Asia, which is, you know, hugely Chinese influenced in Chinese culture, there, you know, these are home cooks and they're just, you know, like my grandmother. She didn't know how hot the oil was to fry chicken. She just got it hot enough and figured out how to tell. And I think nothing wrong with taking it seriously and learning, you know, learning a more advanced approach, but it's just another way to get food on the table, and that's what always appealed to me. I mean, I started doing it not to be a cookbook author on your radio show. I did it because I wanted to eat this food, and I was always amazed at how easy, comparatively, the home cooking is. And I think what happens is people go to Chinese restaurants and Kung Pao chicken, I adore it, but it's a more complicated dish. There's a big marinade and there's a, you know, it's multiple steps. That's not something Chinese people make at home. And Thais don't make pot Thai at home. They go to, you know, they go to a noodle shop to have certain things. Julia Child taught us how to make French bread, but French people go to the baguette store and get baguettes. So what I wanted to do with this book was sort of gather together the homey, approachable ways that Asian people do it. And then I also wanted to just apply that, since this is not all you need to know about Chinese cooking. I also wanted to apply a stir-fry approach to things like, I've got Italian peppers with sausage with peppers and onions.
How did you come up with that one?
Well, I love that dish, and I first encountered it in New York. If you're familiar with New York, there's Canal Street down in Lower Manhattan, and if you go one direction, you go on Mott Street, and you're in New York's Chinatown winding around. If you go Canal Street to the left, you're on Mulberry Street, which is the heart of Little Italy. And I remember going down there to the San Gennaro Festival, which is just a classic New York City Italian Catholic street festival for the Feast of San Gennaro. And I don't know much about San Gennaro, but I do know that Italian sausage vendors were out there, and they were frying these big coils of Italian sausage with peppers and onions, and they'd chop it up and, you know, give you a hard roll and a little basket of that stuff, and I just thought it was so wonderful. And then time went by, and I end up in Southern California 15 years later, and lo and behold, I can buy Italian sausage in the grocery store. That was not true in North Carolina when I was growing up. I'm sure people made it, or you could get it at an Italian deli. And I said, well, I love these flavors. This ought to be something you could stir fry. And you absolutely can.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with a listener now who's waiting to talk with us. Line 4, caller in Normal. You're on the air with Nancy McDermott. Hi.
Hi, my name's Kevin. I live in Normal, and I'm really enjoying your conversation with your guest.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, Kevin.
Mott Street, you know, there's a line in I'll Take Manhattan. Anyway, that's just a reminder of when time I spent in New York. But you gave a brief list of authors or recommended cookbooks on page 345 in your current book.
Yes.
Any comments? I believe is X.J. Kennedy, and I think her breakthrough book was The Gastronomical Me or something. And just any comments with that, and I'll hang up and listen to your program.
S.J. Kennedy, The Gastronomical Me, I am not familiar with that book. And it sounds like a good one to read, but that's not one. As you can see, if you get a look at the book, I didn't have a whole lot of room for this, so it's by no means an exhausted list of Asian cooking resources, but it's about, you know, I've got about 10 or 12 books, and I wanted to sort of spotlight some that are really comprehensive and that give you, you know, a deeper story. You know, this book, my first book, Real Thai, is a deeper story about Thai cooking, although it is, you know, more recipes. I think the one that you're talking about, The Gastronomical Me, sounds like it's, you know, a more of a perhaps essay.
Traveled in Europe and France, and she didn't, it was not so much a cookbook, but it was all focused on food.
Uh-huh.
That she experienced, you know, mm-hmm. different.
Yeah, her books are wonderful.
Ethnicity,
yeah.
In her travels, and I was just wondering if you had any familiarity or comments.
My comment is, I'm putting that on my reading list. It sounds like just what I would love.
And I think caller one of her books, Two Towns in Provence. I think anyway. Is the listener still there?
Yeah, I'm still on.
Yeah. Yeah, I have
Two Towns in Provence.
Yeah, I have enjoyed reading her work. Yes,
vignettes and mm-hmm. essays of, you know, just memorable experiences in different cultures I have not read it myself, but I've heard it referred to, and maybe I'll head off to the
library.
My local library.
Yeah.
Exactly, and then I'm sure it'll make you hungry too.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Yeah, M.F.K. Fisher spent a good deal of time in France after the war, and so that's also interesting, the history of France in recovery.
Right.
Very interesting, and it's her education, I think, as someone who comes to love food.
Right.
So let's take another call now. A listener not too far from normal, caller in Downs. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
The author that he's referring to is M.F.K. Fisher.
Right.
Who wrote any number of wonderful books about food and eating.
Mary Fitzgerald Kennedy Fisher?
Mary Frances.
That's right.
Kennedy Fisher, I believe.
Yes.
She's just, there are lots and lots of absolutely wonderful books.
She wrote the book on narrative food writing. I mean, I think she really pioneered that. And there's so many more narrative books coming out now. I'm reading one called Romancing the Vine by Alan Tardy, Tardi. He was a New York restaurateur of Italian origin, but had never spent much time in Italy, and went over and ended up helping a neighbor work on a vineyard for the first year, and it's quite wonderful. And there's every now and then there's a recipe, but it's really the story with some recipes, which is just, you know, delicious for those of us who love to eat, love to read, love to cook.
I have a little story for you. I teach cooking at a shop in Normal, and the thing that I started out doing was stir fry.
Uh-huh.
And I once said that I thought I had taught everyone in McLean County with a wok how to stir fry.
Yay!
It was such a popular class, and it's not as popular anymore. People are not as interested in cooking Chinese at home, and you don't seem to be able to make that leap with them. But
right.
I had a young woman come up to me in a store, and she said, "I'm so glad I saw you." And I said, she told me she had taken my class. She said she was a graduate student at the time. Someone gave her the class. She was teaching. She said she was eating horribly, fast food, junk.
Right.
And she said, I found out how easy it was. And she said, suddenly I was cooking for my friends, and they were all just amazed. And she said, you changed my life.
Oh.
And it was such a wonderful experience.
Oh, my gosh, that's glorious. I mean, think about that, and think how many people that touches. You touched her, and then all the people who eat at her house, and some of them are going to go cook or encourage somebody.
But the point is, it is so easy.
That's what I hope. You know, I thought, well, 300, does that make people feel like they've got to check them off? But it's really a way to do food. And I think with saying we are going to learn Chinese cooking, then it's sort of like I am going to take on this, you know, this master class. And they're just, you know, some people are going to want to go. I'm sure, you know, you and I, we're going to want to go all the way to Beijing and learn everything about it. But for people who, you know, everybody's got to eat dinner, and, you know, this is such a personal, you and the food and the heat, and it's very primal in a wonderful way, I think.
I tell people the same thing about going to salad bars. I taught my son and a friend of his, and I said, look, you can go buy that cabbage slaw stuff.
Yes!
And, yes! You know, stir fry, and they were both vegetarian, they were both eating cheap. I said, throw in some tofu, stir fry the slaw with some ginger and garlic, season it however you want to, and you've got dinner.
Oh, absolutely. That cheap, ready. You're a cooking teacher. Would you agree that knife, being able to handle a knife,
absolutely,
is a huge barrier?
It's something that I do in every class I teach, no matter what it is. I hold up a chef's knife, I hold up a Chinese cleaver, and I hold up a santoku, and I say, get one of these knives. Watch me learn how to use it. You're going to hate it when you first get it if you've never used a big knife.
Right.
But just slog away because you're going to be so much more efficient. I tell them how to hold their non-dominant hand.
Uh-huh.
So they feel like maybe they can do this without cutting themselves.
Right.
And, you know, not everyone is converted, but
right,
I've had a number of people who have been, and it makes so much difference.
Absolutely. It's, you know, that's sort of the one thing that really opens a lot of doors.
Right.
Or you can, as you said, you can buy the shredded slaw or the shredded carrots.
Or the salad bar.
There's so many ways to go.
And I also said, you can be a good cook without learning to use a big knife. You cannot be an efficient cook.
Right.
And I had a man come up to me after class one day, and he said, I'm retired. I don't care how long it takes. And I said, fine. You just keep your paring knife, and you just keep chopping with your paring knife.
Go, cat, go. What I love about the Chinese cleaver above a French chef's knife is that you chop something up, and then you just push it onto the blade of the knife and walk around the kitchen.
Oh, I know.
It's hard to give that up, sort of capacity.
I want to meet you.
You too.
Because those are exactly the words I use. I scoop it up onto the cleaver, and I say, now you can walk around the kitchen with this.
That's right. Well, you know, these are kitchen truths. It's, you know, every now and then I tell somebody, I'll smush garlic with the side of a cleaver. People go, oh my gosh, that's wonderful. And I think, I didn't make this up. It's sort of all
right,
you know, around and about, and the grandma to
right,
the daughter and the TV show. And you know, but there's just, you know, it's so much fun. And I've been doing this a long time. I'm still not tired of it. And I can't think of a better comment that somebody makes that I made this, you know, you did this, you taught me this, you wrote this, I made it, and I loved it, and so did they. I mean, what a good thing to do in the world.
It is. It's a wonderful thing. Well, thank you very much. I'm appreciating this.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, cooking teacher and food writer Nancy McDermott, her latest book, 300 Best Stir Fry Recipes. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with the telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if that last caller, she can get in touch with you through your website.
Absolutely. There's a contact form, and let me hear from you.
Okay. And Nancy's website is www.nancymcdermott.com. And Nancy is spelled with an I-E, N-A-N-C-I-E, McDermott with two T's at the end, M-C-D-E-R-M-O-T-T. How did the books on cuisines and recipes from Southeast Asia, and then a book on Southern cakes.
that book just came out this summer, and I'm going to food conferences with people that know me, and I've been doing this Asian thing a while and got my shingle out there, and people say, how did you ever learn how to do that? And to me, it's hilarious because I was making cakes when I was 9. I mean, I grew up in North Carolina. My grandmother had a dairy farm and loved to cook, and I was the middle kid, so I loved to go hang out with her and stand on a chair, and she, of course, did not write or use a Southern cake book. She just, you know, she slung the flour and, you know, threw in the eggs and used her hands for all kinds of things, but she made a wonderful coconut cake that was her special triumph, and I just loved cooking. I used cake mix. I got the instant rice and looked on the back and made the rice pudding. I mean, I always gravitated towards sweets. And at that time, it wasn't so unusual. And, you know, you said, when did the wok sort of come in? I think there was kind of the opening of the gourmet door, the door to, you know, European cooking and, you know, bringing in all the knowledge and wisdom and wonderfulness of France and Germany and Spain and, you know, just that whole world of food that nobody much knew about in High Point, North Carolina, where I grew up. So many good things came in with that, but a bad thing is I think people presuming, wow, here is this flourless chocolate torte with some kind of chocolate icing on it that I've never seen. Oh, that's called ganache. And it became a pastry art and something that you go to a fine restaurant and there's this fabulous cake, but people kind of, you know, at the grocery store, here's the cake mix and we're in a hurry, and a couple of generations go by. And I think a lot of people think of, you know, making a cake or making, again, there's this huge gap of, I could never do that. I don't know how. That, you know, that's really something, you know, overwhelming, like a black belt in, you know, Taekwondo. And, of course, to make a gorgeous European-style cake, that is out of my league. But just to put together a scratch cake, and I just always loved the stories, and, you know, I had my grandmother's inspiration. And it used to be something that most women had to do. You know, it was just sort of part of the, you know, a mom's cooking repertoire. And, again, it's the basic American layer cake is a home cake. It's completely doable, and I just sort of always wanted to bring that back.
Yeah. Well, just think about it. Our mothers and grandmothers and the women before them, you know, so often they were doing cooking three times and more a day.
Exactly.
For an entire family.
And on it, often, you know, hot meals and, you know, whatever limited repertoire. And, you know, men could do it, but it was sort of in one way, it's great because it was passed along from woman to woman. And here's this, you know, we have this nostalgia for it, I think. And I have nostalgia for my grandmother's kitchen. But on the other hand, if you were the boy in the family, you were supposed to go out there and fix the car with dad. And now it's kind of, you know, we have all this stuff. I don't have my grandmother here to show me how to do things, but I've got food television, and you can go on the web and find things. And all these books, there are so many, especially for old Southern food, there are books that are gems that are out of print, and yet you can go and read what somebody wrote in 1932 about how to make boiled icing. I just think there's so much richness there, and now anybody can, you know, can kind of dig into it, and, you know, you can find ingredients that my grandmother never heard of.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you've got a couple of girls, a couple of daughters. I don't know how old they are. Are they cooks?
Oh, yes. My older one is 16, and my younger one is 12, and they both love to cook. Now, if your mom is a cookbook author, she's, of course, saying, leave me alone. I got to test this recipe. So the cobbler's children have no shoes. I've not done nearly as much of handing things over to them, but they both just love it. My younger daughter just made herself flat egg for lunch, which is fried egg. We never stopped calling it that. That's what they called it when they were little. And they both helped me test recipes. And they both love to get in there. And rather than help me, you know, they'd rather get in there and do something themselves. But, you know, being in the kitchen with your kids or around your kids, or I just think it's a very sweet practice, because then, you know, you're kind of available. You're doing something. You can delegate them. And, you know, people who see their parents cook are maybe more likely to do it.
Mm. What are their favorites in this book, one from each?
Let me ask Isabel. Isabel?
What?
Isabel is here. She's 12. Do you have a favorite stir-fry recipe?
Hmm.
Hmm. She likes things with mushrooms in them.
Yes.
She's my anything with shiitake mushrooms and anything with fish sauce. I think the Thai recipes were especially popular at my house, partly because, of course, I've been raising them on Thai food all along. The sweet and sour pork. And my husband likes, you know, any sort of beefy or more. My husband is actually Chinese American. He grew up in Taiwan. So the sort of mainline beef with broccoli, beef with oyster sauce. Isabel's favorite, she found it, onion-flavored beef, page 58. And again, not too long of a ingredients list. Soy sauce, water, and cornstarch. You stir those together, and you put that on 3/4 of a pound of thinly sliced beef, and you let that marinate. And then you mix up a tablespoon of oyster sauce, tablespoon of sherry, and a teaspoon of sugar, and a half teaspoon of pepper, and that's your seasoning sauce, and you set that aside. And you heat up a little oil, put in some ginger, put in the beef, which has now got a little soy sauce on it, toss it till it's changed color. Then you add that seasoning sauce and a lot of green onions and toss that up, and it's probably 6 minutes cooking time. And wonderful flavor. It just screams for rice. Or, you know, I say, you know, not only in terms of quantity, but you make these kinds of dishes and you've got, you know, you've got little incredibly tasty bites. So instead of taking a great big bite of a wonderful steak, it's like a little bit of beef with this sauce on it and the green onions, and that seasons your rice. And then you want some cool salad, and then you want some, you know, fruit salad or whatever you've got. But
Boy, well, I think we've inspired some folks this afternoon, Nancy.
Is there a traffic jam in the express lane at the grocery store?
Yeah, I think everybody's reaching for that skillet, reaching for that wok.
Yeah, a large, deep skillet will work. If you got a wok, pull it out, but that should not be a handicap. You know, that should not be a barrier.
Uh-huh. Don't let it get in your way. And get your paring knife out. Whatever you got.
That's right. Start where you are.
That's right. Nancy, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, Celeste, it's an honor and a pleasure to be on your show.
Nancy McDermott has been our guest in this portion of the program. She's a cooking teacher. She's a food writer. She's the author now of 8 books. Her latest, or maybe this is her penultimate, 300 Best Stir-Fry Recipes. She's also the author of the new book, Southern Cakes. In addition to 300 Best Stir-Fry Recipes, her books on Southeast Asian cuisine include Quick and Easy Vietnamese, Real Thai, and Real Vegetarian Thai. The book 300 Best Stir-Fry Recipes, published by Robert Rose.